Welcome to The Bike Show with me, Jack Thurston. This is a special podcast-only edition, continuing our coverage of this year's Tour de France. Today is the last rest day in the Tour before the race heads into the Pyrenees for tomorrow's frighteningly grueling mountain stage around the Circle of Death. The rest day gave me time to catch up with Lionel Burney, The Bike Show's favourite cycling journalist. Lionel writes for Cyclesport magazine and for the Sunday Times. I began our conversation by asking if Lionel was staying in the kind of luxurious accommodation to which the pampered legion of British cycling journalists has grown accustomed.
To be perfectly honest, no, we're not. We're in Mourlas, which is sort of a village, which I thought would be quite a nice little spot in the countryside outside Pau, but it's actually very, very quiet. It's a little bit like an economic downturn theme park, unfortunately, and it's not particularly luxurious, our lodgings at this point. But that's the Tour, unfortunately. You try to enjoy the nice hotels and then endure the less comfortable. But
what's the countryside like? What are the surroundings like where you are? You're in the south of France now, or southwest.
Yeah, we're kind of we're on the plains looking south towards the Pyrenees, so it's kind of flattish territory here near Pau. It's quite attractive countryside, really. It's not as built up and touristy and industrial as the Alps are. It's quite nice, but it's just that our particular village is one that time has forgotten a little bit, I think.
Right, so that would be a farming economy, would it?
I think so, yeah. I'm not entirely sure what the what they do to make ends meet down here. I mean, it's not real holiday making territory. Pau, I mean, is a big town, but you know, it's we're neither in Pau nor up in Toulouse, which obviously is one of the largest cities in France. That's probably the industrial hub of this southwest corner. So you know, out of season, you know, there are ski resorts in the Pyrenees, but in the summer, I think the Tour de France is one of the things that sustains it.
Well, I'm sure they're very grateful for the custom of a handful of British cycling journalists.
Well, don't get me wrong, they're very friendly. I mean, they are very friendly. It's just that the hotel could do with a bit of a clean and a lick of paint.
Okay, well, we'll try and pass that on after you've left. So we're entering it. We're into the last week. This is the final rest day. And you've had a moment to talk to me, for which I'm very grateful. Obviously, the riders are all off at Lourdes, which is quite nearby, you know, making their devotional representations to the Virgin there, hoping for good luck in the days to come as they head towards Paris. But it's going to take a lot of luck for anyone to beat Bradley Wiggins, isn't it? He's in a very, very strong position in the general classification.
He is. 2 minutes and 5 seconds lead is good at any time, but when it's over a teammate, that's an even stronger position. And with the time trial to come on Saturday, it looks very unlikely that anyone's going to unseat him in the mountains, because he's been climbing very well. I mean, one of the sort of the jokes in the press room yesterday was that Bradley could win the Tour de France without having to get out of the saddle, because they've basically kept the attacks so tightly under wraps. And I do wonder, really. I mean, although they probed and had a little go, Cadel Evans and Vincenzo Nibali have not really, you know, they've not really mounted the real sort of barrage of attacks that it's going to take to topple Wiggins. And I just can't see the opportunities for them, even though we've got two very tough Pyrenean stages to come. I'm just not sure that that's going to come.
So how have Sky achieved that? Obviously, Bradley Wiggins has won the time trial and has had teammates around him going up the mountains. Is that it?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, we were talking the other day amongst ourselves over dinner, you know, the tactics of the other riders. They have tried to exploit the perceived weaknesses. Nibali has attacked on the downhills, which is where Wiggins is perhaps a little less comfortable. But really, Sky haven't had to have any tactics. All they've needed is strategy, and their strategy has been very simple, and that was to keep out of trouble in the first week, ride the mountains as if they are a time trial by setting a hard but even pace. There's not been any kind of jerky changes of pace on the climbs. Michael Rogers and Richie Porte in particular have set a very fast, steady pace, which is exactly what Wiggins needs on the climbs. And he's hammered home his advantage, his superiority really, in the time trial. People who understand the aerodynamics of time trialing a little better than me say that there's probably not been a more technically spot-on time trialist in the history of the sport. He's transferred all the knowledge that British Cycling have gathered from Team Pursuiting, and he's applied it to the road. And really, the course hasn't offered enough opportunities to put him on the back foot, and with his team being so strong, that's been even more difficult for his rivals. They're up against three or four of really the best riders in the world. Richie Porte finished seventh in his first Giro d'Italia. I know some people are surprised that he's been riding so strongly, but that shouldn't really surprise people. He's obviously a rider with a great pedigree and a tremendous future in front of him.
Yeah, looking at the Sky team, and particularly looking at Chris Froome, who's been riding very strongly and obviously came second in the Vuelta last year and Wiggins third, I'm somehow reminded of that moment when John Lennon was asked whether Ringo Starr was the best drummer in the world. And he said, "Nah, he's not even the best drummer in the Beatles." Is Bradley Wiggins the best bike rider on Team Sky?
I think in terms of overall package, I think he is. He took 35 seconds from Froome in the time trial, and I expect Wiggins to beat Froome again on Saturday. But in terms of explosive climbing, Froome, if he were on a different team, would probably be able to put Wiggins in more difficulty than any of the other riders have managed to do. But Chris Froome, that was the deal he signed for. He stayed at Sky because they offered him a very attractive contract. But the deal was that Bradley Wiggins was going to be the number one rider for the tour. And whether or not Froome could have won it were it not for that puncture on I think the first road stage. It was the stage to Serang, where he punctured not far from the finish when the peloton was absolutely flying at sort of 70 kilometres an hour, and he lost 1 minute 25. If you took that into account, he would be within 40 seconds of Wiggins overall, and we perhaps have a little bit more of a dilemma, or Sky would have more of a dilemma on their hands. But Froome is the helper, and putting on a sort of pragmatic hat for a moment, in terms of Sky's kind of overall goal, which is to raise the profile of cycling back in Britain, they really do need Bradley Wiggins to win it rather than Chris Froome.
They'd rather have their Belgian-born rider than their Kenyan-born rider.
Well, that's a little bit harsh. Wiggins' father was Australian, but I tried to explain it to somebody earlier in the week and say that it's a bit like Andy Murray trying to win Wimbledon all these years, and then he looks like he's going to do it, and then suddenly somebody else comes through that we've never really heard of and becomes the first British Wimbledon winner in 80 years or whatever it is. The fact of the matter are, back in Britain, if you're dealing with kind of the big media who are effectively carrying this story to the masses, unfortunately, whether we like it or not, the agreed narrative is that Bradley Wiggins wins the Tour de France and becomes the first British Tour champion, and that will resonate more strongly than a Chris Froome victory, because people would have to kind of almost go back to basics, back to square one, and build up that story from scratch almost.
I think you're rather flattering the big media, because I thought the big media would be looking for a Mark Cavendish win in the Tour de France and not quite understanding why that's not happening. But we'll come to Mark Cavendish in a moment. Looking back at the history of the Tour, there have been cases where a helper or a very strong helper or a, you know, co-leader, or not even a co-leader, I suppose. If we look at Roberto Vicentini and Stephen Roach, Contador and Armstrong, or clearly the most famous case, Greg LeMond and Bernardino, Sky have avoided that. Is that as simple as Dave Brailsford having signed a clear contract and a clear understanding with Chris Froome, or have they had to handle anything during the tour itself? Has Chris Froome had to be talked down? There was that moment when he did go on the attack looking for the stage win, presumably. I don't know whether he was also looking to put some time into Bradley Wiggins, but then he was told to come back. And that was featured in an article by L'Equipe. I don't know whether that article was mischievous. Can you enlighten us a little bit on that situation?
Well, from what I gather, the article was based on an interview done with Froome in Italian, translated into French, and then back to English. So you have to kind of allow for a little bit of, something may have got lost in those two translations. It will be interesting. There'll be the Sky press conference later today, so it'll be interesting to see how Froome handles the questions, because on the first rest day, he was solidly behind Bradley Wiggins and saying that he is going to work for Wiggins, and I think he will honour that deal. It's interesting, you mentioned sort of Eno and LeMond and certainly Roach and Vicentini in the Giro in 1987, where two teammates could both win the race, and it kind of all started to bubble over. I wonder, I mean, Sky have done a great job of keeping it in-house. I'm sure that in months to come, more will come out. We're probably at the now, and on this race is probably the worst time to actually find out the real story of what is going on. Once the result is set in stone, and we've reached Paris, and then the Olympics are out of the way towards the end of the season, I'm hoping that there'll be some quite interesting interviews to be done with people who are on the inside of the team. But at the moment, they're all sticking to the script pretty well. It may be that we don't find out just how tense it's been over breakfast until later in the year. And you have to, you know, they're living this out on a sort of social media platform themselves as well. I mean, perhaps not the riders, but certainly Chris Froome's girlfriend has been making some quite spiky comments on Twitter, because she clearly feels that her man is the strongest in the race. And I wonder how that's going down. I mean, Dave Brailsford made a pointed comment the other day saying, we're here to win the Tour de France, not pay attention to what's going on Twitter. He wasn't specifically referring to Chris Froome's girlfriend when he said that, but I'm sure that when people say things like that, I just have this vision of Dave Brailsford checking Twitter on his iPhone perhaps more than he should be.
That's interesting. This is the first Twitter tour, isn't it, really, with Bradley Wiggins's a memorable wig out over the we can't say the words that he used, otherwise Ofcom will give Resonance a yellow card. But it's quite interesting development. I wrote about Twitter and professional bike riding in an article for Cycling Plus several years ago, and thought it would be interesting, but never quite thought it was going to be this interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting. It's interesting in the sense of, it's interesting in a sort of soap opera sense. I'm not sure it adds a great deal of gravitas to events on the road. It is a sideshow, but it's an entertaining one, that's for sure. I mean, what I find strange is that people try to pretend that Twitter isn't important, when clearly it is important to them, because they either take offence to things that are said or they pay attention to things that are said. It's a tricky one, because the riders themselves, you look at their own Twitter feeds during the tour, really they've been pretty much on message, certainly the Sky riders, but they have used it to get one or two little comments out. Mike Rogers, the Australian rider, the other day tweeted just to kind of explain, that he's doing his teamwork job for Bradley Wiggins, because the Australian fans, a small group of them, were booing Rogers and Richie Port, who are both Australian, and they were booing him because they're working against Cadel Evans. I thought Rogers used Twitter there in quite a constructive sense to sort of get his point across. But really, I do wonder whether some of the riders are having to sort of turn their iPhones off, keep their hands in their pockets, for the risk of saying something that they might regret, because media access to all the riders is more controlled now than ever, and so these comments do get seized on even more than perhaps they would ordinarily if we had a little bit more access to the riders at the start and the finish.
One of the most entertaining riders on Twitter is, of course, Mark Cavendish, but he's not having a great tour, is he? Ought he to have started his defence, and ought he to have mounted a defence of the green jersey?
Well, it's a tricky one, because Sky have come here to try and win the race, and that is incompatible with stacking seven riders behind or in front of Mark Cavendish to lead him out for the sprint. You really can't do both. And Cavendish, again, he would have known that, and I think he thought he would take his chances. You, as world champion, as winner of 20 tour stages before this race, there is absolutely, it's almost inconceivable to think that Cavendish would have stayed at home and kind of trained and set his sights solely on the Olympic Games. You know, this is the Tour de France. This is his probably his only chance in his career to ride it in the rainbow jersey. Now, that it's not worked out to his usual high standards, and I'm sure his own high expectations. But I was thinking, when he won the first of, well, the only stage he won so far without a lead out train, the way he kind of jumped from wheel to wheel, almost like sort of Tarzan swinging from vine to vine in the jungle. It was such a skillful move to get to the front and then pit the other riders on the line. The fact that he won without that sprint train, it was almost like in a feature film where you discover that the robot is able to carry on walking towards you despite the sort of raining bullets down on him. He looked almost like, well, there's going to be nothing that's going to stop Mark Cavendish winning a handful of stages again. But of course, it hasn't turned out like that, because he has been left to fend for himself. And that means that he suffered misfortune in the form of a crash. He's been left on the wrong wheels. He's been left with too much to do. So I think the most frustrating one would have been yesterday, the run into Poe, when the Sky team effectively tried to rope in Lotto and Greenedge to help do a bit of the chasing of the escape group. Neither Lotto nor Greenedge fancied it. Sky didn't want to ride hard for an hour or so, bring the group back, so they let the lead go out to 11 minutes, and I felt pretty sorry for Cavendish there, because that would have been a stage that he could have won, and he was just sat there kind of twiddling his thumbs. And I thought it said a lot about him as a character that instead of just riding along with a sulk on his face, he actually got on the front and did a bit of the riding, saved some energy for one of his teammates, that every little helps. And I think Cavendish is grinning and bearing it, though, let's not kid ourselves. He's not going to be thinking to himself, wow, this has been a great tour. But if he wins the Olympic road race next Saturday, none of this will matter, frankly, and he'll be back at the tour in future years and will carry on winning stages. I don't doubt it.
Although presumably Sky, if Bradley Wiggins does win coming back next year, they'll want to do it again, and they won't want to have a big sprinters team. I mean, it is this dilemma is not going to go away for the team, is it?
That is true. I think next year's tour, being the 100th edition of the race, is going to be a sort of greatest hits of the mountains. I think it will be significantly more mountainous than this year, which of course would mean perhaps Chris Froome would be the best bet. That is fascinating. The fascinating dilemma they've got. Think back 3 weeks. The whole problem that we thought they had was, how on earth are they going to accommodate Wiggins and Cavendish? And actually, as we go into the third week, the dilemma has changed to, how on earth do we accommodate Wiggins, Cavendish and Froome? And you're right, next year, if Wiggins is the defending champion, he will have to come back and put up some form of defence. Froome will presumably, well, he's already been quoted as saying he would hope that if he were to prove himself the strongest climber, that Sky would back him with the same level of loyalty that he's shown, and Cavendish is going to want to win stages. So it is a dilemma, but look, what a great dilemma to have. There are teams in this race that have barely mustered a top 10 place. So I don't, my heart doesn't exactly bleed for them. I mean, they look incredibly strong. And I thought one of the most telling comments from the other riders was when David Miller tweeted a photo of the Sky bus parked outside their hotel. And he said, I pulled back the curtains this morning and I'm greeted with this sight. It's the Death Star.
Death Star for the chances of other teams. Although David Miller had a terrific stage victory himself, didn't he? That was a great, great ride.
It was. Again, Miller is one of the most intelligent riders when it comes to sorting out his strategy at the end of a race like that. You know, his pedalling style is so smooth, he looks so comfortable, and he was able to judge exactly what move to follow when Perrault made the move, you know, perfect, because he was going to, the French guy, Jean-Christophe Perrault, is a good climber, so he was able to get away on that little hill before the finish. Miller reacted promptly. He shared the work, so there was no messing about. They opened the gap up, and then he thought through his finish perfectly. And I think, you know, the fact that he then came into the press conference and said on French television, at his highest point, really, he was able to reflect on his lowest ebb and say that we must never forget that I'm an ex-doper, but I'm clean now, I thought spoke volumes for him and his rehabilitation and his standing in the sport now.
Yes, it certainly does. On those flat sprint stages, we've had a terrific contest between Cavendish, the opportunist, André Greipel with this terrific lead-out train, and the joker in the pack, Peter Sagan, or Sagan. Have you figured out what the correct Slovak pronunciation is? It's Sagan, I would imagine.
I think it's Sagan, yes. Yeah, Peter Sagan.
And we in Britain may remember this tour as the tour that brought British cycling to the very highest levels in the Tour de France. But looking back in 20 years' time, it's possible that we might remember this tour as the start of the Sagan era. He's a terrifically strong rider, isn't he?
He is. You know, he's. It's not really surprised me in terms of what he's been able to do. The stage wins that he's racked up just shows that he's got this appetite and this desire, which, you know, for a 22-year-old, he's raced every day of this race as if it's his last. And, you know, we gather that he's absolutely desperate to win this green jersey, which is why he's gone out on the attack and on the sort of mountain stage to try and get points in the intermediate sprint and then try and get more points at the finish. It's a sort of insatiable desire that he's got. He's a big lad. He's 80 kilograms, just under, I think. You know, he's solidly built. And of course, it's the usual question of, you know, could a rider with his power, his ability and his sprint finish, could he shed a few kilos and turn himself into a rider capable of finishing in the top places overall in future? Of all the people that we've said this about, I don't see why not. The other day when they went over the Mur de Peguer, he was absolutely killing himself to stay on the, just off the back of the leading riders. I think it was Sandy Cassari who went over the top first, who's no slouch in the mountains. And what impressed me was that Sagan, he could have allowed the gap to open a little bit, give himself a little bit of a break, knowing that he would definitely close the gap on the descent, because he's a good descender anyway. But he, over the course of that descent, he would have got back up to the front group. But instead of just cutting himself some slack, he was turning himself inside out and was in fact closing the gap as he got towards the top. And I think that said so much about what his appetite and desire for the race is. And if he maintains that in the coming years, it could be that we are about to enter a sort of an era of Peter Sagan dominance, certainly in the green jersey. Unless they change the rules, I think it will be very difficult for anyone with this current setup of the big intermediate sprint and these kind of middle mountain stages and uphill finishes. I mean, he's 100 and something points clear. I can see him dominating that competition unless they tweak the way the points are distributed.
Is he a kind of Tom Boonen style rider that, you know, Tom Boonen was very good at in the tour. I mean, I guess a little bit more of a straight out sprinter in some ways, but then has become this incredibly good classics rider. Do you think that's the more likely scenario than the weight loss and become a sort of a GC contender in the Grand Tours?
It probably is, certainly in the shorter term. I mean, look back at Sagan's classics results this year from Milan-San Remo through to Amstel Gold, I think. I mean, he was in the top places in just about every classic, second, third, fourth, fifth. He's inches away from winning one of those, and I would expect him to win a classic in the next, if not next year, then certainly the year after. He's a much more of a racer than Tom Boonen, and Tom Boonen would stick in and wait for the sprint, and now really he wouldn't be troubling Greipel or Cavendish if he were here in the Tour de France sprinting. He's gone in a different direction. And Sagan, he's got this fast finish, but it's the aggression about him that I like. You know, he has gone on the attack. He even the day when Nibali was trying to get away on the descent, Sagan was up in the lead break and then killed himself to try and help his teammate gain a little bit of time. He's just a bike racer, and his appetite for it is quite extraordinary.
And obviously he's got these terrific finish salutes over as he goes over the line, the dancing chicken, the running man from Forrest Gump. Hasn't got to Hong Kong Phooey yet, has he?
No, we've I'm glad you've defined them for me, because I'm struggling to remember what they were. I remember the first stage here with his with whether it was running man or sort of cross-country skiing, I wasn't sure which. People were sort of saying it was disrespectful, but I mean, he's 22 years old, winning his first stages in his debut Tour de France. It's supposed to be sport. Professional sport shouldn't lose sight of the fact that it's supposed to be entertaining. And if people, you know, if that puts a smile on people's faces when they watch the race on TV, then I'm all for that. You know, this kind of, you know, he's won the race. I think you're perfectly entitled to come up with something, you know, a little bit different, a little bit entertaining. I mean, Cavendish got criticised in the past for pretending to be on a mobile phone or, you know, pointing to his to his sponsored logo. Yeah, that's a slightly different approach, but you know, the Tour is always crying out for new characters, and I think this year we've found one.
And do you think Cavendish will make it to the Champs-Élysées, and will we see a really exciting sprint there between Cavendish, Greipel and Sagan on the Champs-Élysées?
I think he will make it. He's got two difficult mountain stages to get through, Wednesday and Thursday. There's a possibility that if Lotto and Orica Green Edge were to assist, there's a possibility of a sprint finish in Brive on Friday. I think that on the Champs-Élysées, Sky will go to the front. They will lead the last lap, and they will give Cavendish a lead out deluxe. And I've got a sneaking feeling that Bradley Wiggins will do a massive turn on the front in his yellow jersey to lead out his teammate, and that it will be all smiles on the Champs-Élysées, and they'll head back to London pretty much in the best shape possible.
Well, that's quite a prediction. We couldn't have imagined that from a British team 3-4 years ago, and maybe even 2 years ago. It's also been, and I must mention this quickly in passing, a great tour for the French teams, hasn't it?
It has. Well, certainly a couple of them. Europcar and Française du Jour certainly have had had a great time. They've won two stages each. Cofidis and Saur Sojasun have not done anything like as well. But we were discussing this over dinner last night, and it is important for the race that the French are an active part in it, because otherwise, you know, it slips off the front page of L'Équipe. Certainly when the football was still going on in the, you know, over the first weekend, the Tour plays second fiddle, which is extraordinary, really, considering it is, you know, it's such a huge event. The French victories, stage victories, and the breakthrough of particularly Thibaut Pinot, who won, I'm struggling to remember exactly where that was. It was the day after Froome won. It was in Porrentruy in Switzerland, where Pinot won for Française des Jeux. People are getting very excited about him. He's only 22 as well. This is his first tour. And he's, I think, from memory, still 9th or 10th overall. So he's looking like he could be up there as with Pierre Rolland, competing to be the first Frenchman home. It's vital for the race that there's a good, strong French presence. And personally, I enjoy watching the tactical, the way that Thomas Vauclair and Pierrick Federigo tactically approach winning stages, because it's easy to say they get into a break and then finish it off and just kind of dismiss it as almost a day off for the peloton. But when you think of the strike rate of somebody like Vauclair, he gets in two breaks a year, or two or three breaks in the Tour, and he wins one. Or Federigo gets in one break this year, one break in 2010, and their strike rate of actually converting an aggressive move into a victory is really impressive. And I think we lose sight of that a little bit because we're so fixated on the sprints and the overall picture.
Yes, and there have been some complimentary remarks made about the DSs, the directeurs sportifs of the French teams, being very canny, as well as obviously their riders being canny.
Yeah, I think the cliche was that the French didn't train, or they didn't, you know, they didn't think scientifically, or they didn't think about tactics, or, you know, there's been a whole range of them over the last few years, that because they are French and because it's their race, that it's almost enough to pin on their number and call yourself a Tour de France rider. I think that's definitely changed in the last 2 or 3 years. I mean, Madio has developed riders from FDJ. And keeps finding them, and eventually they become too expensive and they move on somewhere else, and that's his role in the sport, and his position is that he's trying to develop people, and Pino certainly looks to be, you know, the real deal. The way he won his stage, which was timed with absolute perfection, he closed down the leading rider and went past him on the last climb, and then soloed to the finish with Madio hanging out of the car door, slapping his fist on the car door. You know, absolutely, you know, it made his Tour, and it made the Tour for their team, and that's not patronizing to say you know, that we should commend that, but you look at some of the other teams and you think, well, could you not take a leaf out of Madio's book, or out of Jean-René Bernadeau's book, who's a Europe car manager, and, you know, try and think a little bit differently, try and make the racing in a bit more of an aggressive manner, because there are some days when really we need a little bit of that kind of Gallic panache, I suppose, because otherwise, you know, some of the stages would have, for example, yesterday running into Poe, but for quite an exciting tactical conundrum between those leading six riders yesterday was enough to send you to sleep, to be perfectly honest. So I'm all for the French, and I give them a cheer when they pull one off.
We'll obviously have to talk about this after the Tour is finished, but looking back over the stages to date, has this been a vintage Tour?
Absolutely, honestly, no, not really. I mean, from a professional point of view, working for a British newspaper, which also is part of one of the companies that is a sponsor of Team Sky, not that that affects my editorial line at all, but certainly in terms of the audience, you know, the Bradley Wiggins story is the only show in town. If this was, for argument's sake, a Dutch team and a Dutch rider, or a Spanish team and a Spanish rider, and they were riding in exactly the same way, and they had first and second on GC, and the race had played out in identical circumstances, I think we would be nodding off. And I remarked yesterday, the media corps on the Tour has, it seems to me, to have almost halved since the opening few days. It used, back at the start, the press room was absolutely rammed, and yesterday I looked around and it was really quiet, and there isn't a kind of frisson, there isn't a wealth of really intriguing stories, because effectively the race is over, unless Bradley Wiggins has some kind of terrible catastrophe in the Pyrenees and completely, you know, implodes. It's done and dusted, and from the point of view of a sporting spectacle, that is a shame. But from the point of view of somebody working for British publications, it's you know, it's a great story, and the fact that we've covered, you know, I mean, I remember talking to Bradley Wiggins when he was junior world champion back in 98, and to have followed his career from that point to this, you know, gives it a depth and a kind of, you know, it gives it a depth and a number of layers that, for the first time, really, you know, we've got that level of kind of understanding of where the tour champion has come from, which is why, you know, when Contador wins or you know, a rider from another country wins, their media, you know, they're the ones that have got all the stories and all of the background knowledge and all of the interest, and that's, and they're the guys that are sort of filling the press conferences and asking all the questions. So I can understand why the French, Spanish, the Italians perhaps aren't as wild about the overall race, because it hasn't really been a race. It's been a tightly controlled, I won't say procession, because that sounds disrespectful to the level of effort that Sky are having to expend in order to make it look so controlled. But
It's something that they trained for.
Absolutely, yeah. They've planned this. I mean, that's the big thing, is when people sort of say, it's a bit formulaic, it's a bit boring, perhaps. It was never going to be any other way. This is exactly how they rode in the Dauphiné in 2011, exactly how they rode in the Dauphiné in 2012. They have planned this, and they've recruited the riders to be able to fill the roles. You know, Edvald Bosenhagen is one of the best riders in the world, but he's doing absolutely nothing for himself. He's riding 50, 60, 70 kilometers on the front in the early parts of the mountain stages, sacrificing any thoughts of trying to win a stage. So, yeah, it's been meticulous, it's been methodical, but a bit like watching baseline rally tennis, it's just lacking that little bit of flair. It's a clinical, scientific approach, you know, whether or not that takes the joy. I personally think it takes the joy out of it. But Tim Kerrison studies the power data from every single day, and is able to tell you whether, you know, is Wiggins gone? Has he gone too deep? Is he able to replicate that power for another X number of 45-minute efforts? And the answer is yes. You know, they know what Wiggins can do as long as he's not unwell. And because power is the real key, if your power tails off dramatically, then you know that the guy is weakening. And they are so far on top of that, even down to things like the warm down, which everyone takes the mickey out of. Other teams have started copying that now. But Kerrison said to me last week, he said, yeah, it's all very well getting onto the rollers or the turbo trainer after the stage, but do they know what they're doing? You don't just get off and spin your legs for. It's a structured, gradual kind of warm down, and it's done to power numbers. It's like you get on, and you know the first 5 minutes are still at a fair effort, and then it eases up and eases up and eases up. And he understands the physiology and the theory of how muscles recover and how they basically how best to replenish and repair muscle after serious hard effort. And that's what it's all based on. Unfortunately, that's very scientific. It's not particularly glamorous. There's certainly no panache in it. But that's what all sports have been boiled down to. I mean, I keep going back to the tennis analogy because I think it works. They've all got rackets that are strung in a certain way. You know, the tension is a certain... There's a rule that stops them from having certain string designs, but basically the technology has taken out the art, and that has happened in an awful lot of sports. So in something like cycling, there's so much more science to it than art. It's just that the history of the sport has all been, you know, we've been sold the vision that we're looking at the, you know, we're looking at the, I don't know, the Renaissance masters, when actually really what we're looking at is some architect's drawings.
That's a great analogy, actually. That's a terrific analogy.
I think that's something that I might say for a piece towards the end of the tour. You know, has it been good to watch?
Well, Lionel Burney, thank you very much for joining us and sharing your analysis.
Thank you very much. It's been fun.
I was talking with Lionel Burney. You can follow him on Twitter at Lionel J. Burney and read his articles in Cyclesport magazine and in the Sunday Times. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the rest of the tour. Goodbye.